was Mademoiselle Brigitte Friang. Brigitte was well known in Indochina, since she was the only woman reporter in the whole command who held a military parachutes diploma and a record of 5 combat jumps, including that of the 6th BPC's desperate rearguard action in November 1952 at Toulé. The hustle and bustle inside Dien Bien Phu was taking on a semblance of order. General Gilles, equipped with a paratroop scooter, could be seen traveling from his own headquarters to the various battalion command posts, while the lesser-ranking officers made do with bicycles. A few of the more enterprising junior officers had simply taken to the Thai mountain ponies. Quite a few were found tethered under Thai peasant houses, which are all built on stilts. Intensive spade work had made part of the airfield ready to receive small aircraft, and the combat engineers began to lay long rows of prefabricated PSPs, pierced steel plates, to form what was eventually to become a steel runway 3,500 feet long. Throughout the valley, the air smelled of burning wood as the troops began to clear the approaches to the airfield and the hills and plains, which later were to become part of the various strong points. There was now a total of 4,560 troops in the valley. As for the Thai inhabitants, quite a few of them had fled in fright into the nearby mountains from where they observed the strange goings-on in their villages. But since they had had a long association with the French, they now began timidly to return to their homes. Soon a brisk trade began, with soldiers and villagers exchanging canned rations for fresh fowl and vegetables, while small Thai children, with uninhibited curiosity, formed groups around paratroopers going about their pursuits. The radio operators, with their squawking sets, proved the main attraction. The first outside visitor to arrive at Dien Bien Phu was the commander of the Northern Theater, General René Cogny. He emerged early on Sunday afternoon from a small Canadian-built Beaver liaison aircraft, otherwise loaded with bicycles. A blue-eyed giant of a man, Cogny was France's youngest major general. A heavy knotted cane helped him to cope with a severe limp, a reminder of the general's treatment at the hand of the Gestapo when he led a resistance group against the Nazis during World War II. This earned him Gestapo torture and a 2-year stretch in the infamous death camps of Buchenwald and Dora, from which he was liberated only after VE Day. Much will be said later about Cogny's role in the planning of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and his overall command of it. As he landed at Dien Bien Phu, he was already aware of the fact that many senior officers of his command, notably Bastiani and Gilles, had been opposed to the idea of establishing another airhead behind communist lines. A few months earlier, on August 12th, Na San, an airhead far closer to Hanoi than Dien Bien Phu, had finally been evacuated because it had tied down more troops and more air transport than it was worth. At that time, everyone had agreed that sealed-off, hedgehog positions were hardly worth the cost of maintaining them. But, as will be seen, Dien Bien Phu was picked precisely because the valley, the largest in all of Indochina's northern mountain areas, was far too large to become a hedgehog position in which the French troops could be sealed off. Here, there was space for maneuvering. Tanks could be employed if they could be brought in by air, as indeed they were, later. General Gilles, particularly, who had personally conducted the difficult defense of Na San for 6 long months and had earned his general's stars there, in the French army, brigadier generals wear 2 stars, did not want to go through the same sort of experience again. "I'll be pretty happy," he was to say privately to Cogny that afternoon, in the Catalan-accented French that was spoken in his home district in the Pyrenees, "when you will have found a successor for me here. At Na San, I spent 6 months of my life like a rat. Make use of me somewhere where I am going to be in fresh air." "It's a promise," said Cogny. "It's just a matter of days." While Cogny and Gilles were talking, the first flight of 3 Morane 500 observation aircraft of the 21st GAOA, Aerial Artillery Observation Group, nicknamed Crickets because of their grasshopping ability and their high landing gear struts, had also landed on the airstrip. Gradually reinforced to a total of 6 aircraft, they were to become the eyes of the fortress. In the meantime, another facet of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu was taking place about 60 miles to the north, in the airhead of Lai Chau. Lai Chau had been the capital of the whole Thai Federation and the seat of the federal president, Deo Van Long. Like Dien Bien Phu, Lai Chau had been cut off from the outside world for more than 2 years. its tiny airstrip, bounded on one end by a river and on the other by the first houses of the small town, was far more exposed than the airstrip of Dien Bien Phu. In fact, the pilots used to say that Lai Chau was the only airport in the world where flying aircraft could be shot down by anti-aircraft machine guns firing down on them. Gun positions hidden in the high hills commanded this last toehold of French territory inside the communist zone. Late in 1953, it became obvious that even a modest effort on the part of the Viet Minh forces could result in military disaster at Lai Chau, a military setback that could be complicated by the political consequences of losing the last government seat in the mountain areas. It was this political consideration which had weighed heavily in the French decision to reoccupy another stronghold in the Thai tribal zone. On November 4, 1953, it was decided to evacuate Lai Chau and to transfer the government of the Thai Federation to the new airhead at Dien Bien Phu. The French commander at Lai Chau, Lieutenant Colonel Trancard, was informed of the planned evacuation of Lai Chau, dubbed Operation Pollux, on November 13th. Trancard immediately ordered the withdrawal to Dien Bien Phu of the 1st Thai Partisan Mobile Group, GMPT-1, led by the Eurasian son-in-law of Deo Van Long, Captain Bordier. The withdrawal of the 700 men through terrain which they knew well did not at first present any special problems. However, roving units of Regiment No. 148 finally caught up with them when they were 2 days' march away from Dien Bien Phu, and the last leg of their march became a continuous battle against well-laid communist ambushes. These had to be broken up with mortar fire and continuous counterattacks. General Gilles ordered Bressignac's 2-1 RCP to head north on November 23rd at 06:30 until it had linked up with the Thai partisans. Reporter Brigitte Friang went northward with the paratroops. They met GMPT-1 at the village of Ban Na Ten, 7 kilometers north of Dien Bien Phu, without encountering the slightest enemy opposition. Most of the French and the Thai officers were mounted on sturdy local ponies. The tribesmen themselves were dressed in French army fatigues and wore slouch hats. They seemed hardly the worse for wear after their week-long trek and almost continuous firefights. As the Thai entered the valley, their officers made them assume a sort of military order, and the unit flags were unfurled. The GMPT-1 carried the French flag and the flag of the Thai Federation. 3 vertical stripes of blue, white, and blue, with a 16-pointed red star, representing the 16 Chao, or feudal baronies, of the Thai Federation, in the center of the white field. No Vietnamese flag was in sight. Bressignac's paratroops presented arms as the tribesmen filed by them. In Paris, the news of Operation Castor came after almost all Friday newspapers had already been put to bed. But on Saturday, November 21st, most papers carried banner headlines whose uniformly overstated figures indicated that French official sources had deliberately provided the press with exaggerated statistics. A typical headline, that of Paris Presse, read, "Lightning-like operation in Tongking. Parachuted from 150 Dakotas, thousands of French-Vietnamese paratroopers conquered Dien Bien Phu. This is not a raid. We've taken the place and we shall stay there," declares General Cogny. Aside from the communist press, to which the attack on Dien Bien Phu was merely another act of colonialist aggression, only the reliable Le Monde was a great deal less sanguine about the operation. Eschewing the black headlines, it gave a restrained account of the operations, including the same figures that had been fed to all the other papers, but added the following cautionary note. "It is not certain, however, that the enemy will not soon react. The whole area of Dien Bien Phu, and the whole Thai country in general, is a major opium-producing area, from which the Viet Minh draws many of its resources, and particularly the means of paying the deliveries in materiel, arms, and ammunition from Communist China. Ho Chi Minh also uses clandestine sales of opium in all of Indochina to finance his intelligence services and his propaganda, and to pay his troops." This view of the situation at Dien Bien Phu proved to be entirely correct. In itself, as a rich valley providing a ready access route to Laos, Dien Bien Phu was a desirable piece of real estate. When French planning put into that valley numerous French troops operating with relatively little artillery and armor and at the extreme range of their combat aircraft, the Communist High Command began to find the valley of Dien Bien Phu most attractive. 2. Das Aeroterrest. Dien Bien Phu is not really a place name. It actually designates a Thai village whose true name is Muang Thang, but all of the villages in the valley are not necessarily Thai. Those located high up on the slopes are inhabited by dour-looking Mayo tribesmen. It is they who specialize in the growing of opium poppies. The Thai, who control the valleys, are mostly the middlemen who market it. Until 100 years ago, the valley had been largely isolated from the outside world, but gained some importance as a roadway into the Mekong Basin during the period when Chinese Ho pirates began to invade northern Laos in the 1870s. When the Ho pirates nearly overran all of northern Laos in 1887, the enterprising French consul there, Auguste Pavie, asked for the help of French troops in Tonkin to pacify the northern approaches of both Laos and Vietnam. On April 7, 1889, Pavie personally signed a protectorate agreement with the powerful leader of the Ho, Deo Van Tri, at Muang Thanh. Since the village was located at the limit of the area controlled by the Vietnamese administration, it came to be known in Vietnamese as the seat of the border county prefecture, which in Vietnamese is translated as Dien Bien Phu. For the next 50 years, the people of the valley led uneventful lives. The valley was eventually connected with the outside world on the Vietnamese side by Provincial Road 41, which was accessible to sturdy automobiles during the dry season. In fact, its motorable part ended at Dien Bien Phu. A rough track, known as Piste Pavie, Pavie Track, connected Dien Bien Phu with the seat of the Thai tribal territory at Lai Chau. The sum total of the French colonial presence in the valley was a junior civilian resident administrator whose key job was to control the size of the opium shipments, since the sale of opium in formerly French Indonesia was a state monopoly. There was also a small detachment of the locally recruited Garde Indochinoise in Lai Chau. When aviation came to Indochina in the late 1920s, the French government began to clear small airstrips in hundreds of places throughout the jungles of the country, inasmuch as the fragility of the airplanes of the time required that they make frequent emergency landings. The advent of World War II did not change the Shangri-La pace of Dien Bien Phu. The valley's very remoteness made it an asset to the Allied cause, since French Air Force planes, theoretically under Vichy French and Japanese control, but in fact working covertly for the Allies, were able to use the Dien Bien Phu airstrip to receive free French envoys and officers from Calcutta. On two occasions, French aircraft used Dien Bien Phu to smuggle out American flyers who had been compelled to bail out from their crippled planes over Japanese-controlled areas of Indochina. When the Japanese attacked the remaining French forces in Indochina on March 9, 1945, Dien Bien Phu became, for almost 2 months, the headquarters of last-ditch French resistance against Japanese aggression. Small aircraft from the U.S. 14th Air Force of General Claire L. Chennault landed at Dien Bien Phu with supplies for the French, and two obsolete French Potez 25 fighter planes, using the airstrip as a temporary base of operations against the advancing Japanese, flew 150 hours in 40 days before they had to withdraw to Free China. Although the Japanese occupied Dien Bien Phu for less than 2 months, they were not remembered with fondness. It was later said that the Japanese had great plans for the Dien Bien Phu airstrip, including making it a major strategic airbase for further operations against the key American airbases in nearby Yunnan. In any case, the Japanese never had time to carry out their grandiose schemes and limited their activities at Dien Bien Phu to lengthening the existing grass strip with the help of local unpaid forced labor. When the Japanese departed soon after VJ Day, they were replaced by Chinese nationalist forces, whose job it was, according to decisions reached in July 1945 at Potsdam, to occupy all of Indochina down to the 16th parallel and to intern the Japanese troops there. As in other places in Indochina, the Chinese proceeded to rob the countryside bare and are even less fondly remembered than the Japanese. Returning French units found Chinese nationalist forces reluctant to give up the good life they were leading. A mixed column of French paratroopers and Thai partisans stood eyeball to eyeball with the Chinese forces in Dien Bien Phu for a few unpleasant days in the spring of 1946, until the latter finally decided to obey the orders of their own government and withdraw to China. The people of Dien Bien Phu were ready to return to their leisurely way of life, but times had changed. Deo Van Long, the successor of Deo Van Tri to the chieftaincy of the Thai Federation, decided to remove Lo Van Hock, the able district chief of Dien Bien Phu, and to give his job to one of his own sons. In anger, Lo Van Hock joined the Viet Minh guerrillas, who had begun to operate in the mountain areas. Deo Van Long, in return, imprisoned Lo's wife. The fact that Deo Van Long was a white Thai and Lo Van Hock was a black Thai exacerbated the quarrel. Further, the presence of pro-communist Viet Minh was to have serious effects later on. With the onslaught of communist regular forces on the highlands as of October 14, 1952, matters changed. The Viet Minh's 308th, 312th, and 316th Divisions, reinforced by Independent Regiment No. 148, crossed the Red River on a broad front and overran the first line of French defensive positions in less than a week. Only temporarily slowed down by the deliberate sacrifice of French paratroops, the Viet Minh reached the French main line of resistance along Provincial Road 41. There, French resistance centered on the airstrip of Na San. Thanks to a continuous stream of airlifted troops and artillery, Na San was hastily transformed into what the French called a base aéroterrestre, an air-land base, or, in American military parlance, an airhead. In the case of Na San, the defenses around the airstrip comprised two complete rings of strongpoints, whose automatic weapons were mutually supporting. These, in turn, were supported by the howitzers of the airhead's artillery. A motley garrison, hurriedly scraped together by French Commander-in-Chief General Raoul Salan, consisted of paratroop remnants, Moroccans, Vietnamese, foreign legionnaires, and two battalions of Thai mountaineer riflemen. The communist commander, General Vo Nguyen Giap, no doubt inspired by the then-current success of human wave attacks in Korea, concentrated both the 308th and 312th Divisions on Na San in order to overrun that strongpoint before the French had a chance to consolidate their position. Although the outer strongpoint line was twice breached, the French garrison beat back the attacks successfully. Na San held and became the shining symbol of French ability to withstand a massive communist assault on an organized position. The victory at Na San, unfortunately, also provided the theoretical underpinning for a whole new approach to the fighting in Indochina, an approach that was to become the official military strategy of Salan's successor, General Henri Navarre. While Giap laid siege to Na San, a part of his forces bypassed the French hedgehog and plunged deeper into the Thai territory, sweeping aside the light screen of small outposts which stood between them and the border of Laos. The French high command suddenly became aware of the new danger and hurriedly marched a Laotian light infantry battalion from San Noa to Dien Bien Phu. But it was obviously no match for all of the Viet Minh's 316th Division plus the 148th Independent Regiment. Dien Bien Phu was evacuated without a fight on November 30, 1952. The retreating French Laotian troops destroyed a small bridge across the Nam Yam River. For the first time, the Viet Minh's red flag with a five-pointed gold star in the center flew over the yellow stucco building of what had been the residence of the French administrator. It was not to be the last time. In the grim picture of the situation in northwestern Vietnam at the end of 1952, the loss of Dien Bien Phu was considered a minor incident. The French briefing officer of the Northern Command in Hanoi explained it to assembled reporters. Dien Bien Phu is not a strategic sector. At times in the past, rebel bands have penetrated it, but have let it go again. Their occupation of this hole in the ground isn't yet the invasion of Laos. While technically his statement was true, since the jungle-going Viet Minh forces were quite capable of invading Laos through places other than a convenient river valley, as indeed they did later, the journalists and other observers knew that the loss of the whole highland area, save for the airhead of Na San and the province of Lai Chau, constituted a severe French defeat. The occupation of Dien Bien Phu in particular gave the Viet Minh an open door into northern Laos. General Salan, despite what his press officer said, was perfectly aware of the importance of the valley of Dien Bien Phu. In a top-secret directive, No. 40, issued exactly 1 month after the occupation of the valley by the communists, he ordered a counterattack for January 10, 1953. In his directive, Salan stated, "The reoccupation of Dien Bien Phu must constitute, in the forthcoming period, the first step for the regaining of control of the Thai country and for the elimination of the Viet Minh from the area west of the Black River. Directive 40 was passed down from the High Command for execution by the Northern Commander, General René Coigny. His staff, in turn, on January 7, 1953, issued to participating commanders Note No. 14, detailing certain aspects of Directive 40. In Note 14, the aims of the new counteroffensive directed at Dien Bien Phu were somewhat more limited. They were to A. deprive the rebels of a base and communications hub, and B. permit the mopping up of the province. Because of the French Army's urgent commitments in the Red River Delta, where the situation had badly deteriorated, and the diversion of large French forces to Nassan and Operation Lorraine, Salan never was able to assemble the troops necessary to implement the reconquest of Dien Bien Phu. The retrieval of the whole Thai territory between the Black and Red Rivers was out of the question. Nevertheless, the idea of Dien Bien Phu as a major strategic base in the North Vietnamese highlands, covering Laos and at the same time threatening the Viet Minh's rear areas, began to take hold. Salan was soon to return to France after a tour of duty of almost 4 years in Indochina. He had served as deputy to the late Marshal Jean de Lattre de Tassigny, and after de Lattre's death from cancer in January 1952, became commander-in-chief in his own right. Before Salan left Indochina, he addressed two aide-memoirs to his civilian superior in Paris, the minister in charge of relations with the Associated States, in which he emphasized Dien Bien Phu's importance. On February 28, 1953, Salan underlined the possibility of a defense of the highlands from strong points such as Nassan, Lai Chau, and, eventually, Dien Bien Phu, while in his communication of May 25, 1953, after his successor had already arrived in Indochina, but 3 days before Navarre took effective command, Salan underlined the usefulness of a reconquest of Dien Bien Phu as a stepping stone to the relief of the garrison of encircled Nassan. There can therefore be no doubt that the importance of Dien Bien Phu had become ingrained in French military thinking. Since General Salan is serving a life sentence for attempting mutiny in Algeria in April 1961, it has been impossible to determine whether, upon his return to France in June 1953, he continued to advocate a strategy based on the creation of more air-supplied hedgehogs. In view of what came later, it is certain that Salan's Directive 40 and his efforts to implement it must have made it easy for his successor to follow in his footsteps. Lieutenant General Henri Navarre, who took command of the Destinies of Indochina on May 28, 1953, and who, rightly or wrongly, will be remembered in history as the man who lost the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, is a complicated man. An article published in a French army magazine in Indochina while Navarre was commander-in-chief contains the following revealing passages. The commander-in-chief of the French Union forces advanced toward the small group of officers standing at attention who had come to greet him, and coldly shook the hands of two or three of them. General Navarre is the happy owner of a Persian cat, and hides from no one the fact that he adores cats because they prefer to be alone and because they have an independent way of thinking. And Navarre, who is extremely sensitive, belongs to the category of people who are not afraid to be alone, who work alone, and find their strength within themselves. His own subordinates find him to be a good boss, because he never comes to bother them while they are executing an order. Navarre is master of his nerves. Navarre won't stand for a job sloppily done, and Navarre never admits extenuating circumstances. It is said that he has kept, from the years he spent in intelligence, the respect for secrecy and a taste for mystery. Major General René Coigny, his subordinate commander in North Vietnam at the time of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, was to say of him 10 years later, "That air-conditioned general froze me. As for his way of thinking, it disconcerted me like an electronic computer which I do not succeed in feeding the necessary basic data, and which, unperturbed, bases its reasoning on I don't know what. Perhaps I am better inspired in remembering the professional deformation of the man who served in intelligence and whose reasoning finally becomes crooked because he must deal with so many crooked people." And the French author Jules Rat, whose views of Navarre were to involve him in a public exchange of letters with the general, described him as physically and morally a feline, and simultaneously cordial and distant, debonair and icy. Time magazine, which devoted a cover story to Navarre on September 28, 1953, provided American readers with the kind of quotable gems about him which are the trademark of that publication when it decides to give a favorable build-up to a good guy. There is an 18th-century fragrance about him. He is a portrait on a cameo from the time of Louis XV. One almost expects ruffles and the powdered wig. He is the hardest general I know, clever and ruthless. He believes in nothing but the army. Time also found an anonymous official in Washington willing to provide Navarre with an American accolade. In our opinion, Navarre is a man of courage, energy, and imagination. He knows his business and has military and political guts of a high order. He is leading a new team, which looks pretty good to us. And Time ended its profile of the new commander with another quotation. A year ago, none of us could see victory. There wasn't a prayer. Now we can see it clearly, like light at the end of a tunnel. But Navarre's character came through perhaps more clearly in a friendly press interview that he gave almost 10 years after the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, in response to the reporter's passing allusion to the alleged fact that after the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, a group of French officers in Indochina had sent him a beautifully lacquered box with a loaded pistol inside, a clear reference to the tradition that a senior commander should not survive a major defeat. Navarre's remarks were as follows. I would not have done it in any case. Aside from any other consideration, to commit suicide would have meant absolving everybody else from any responsibility by recognizing myself guilty. I have a very strong feeling of responsibility for Dien Bien Phu. I have no feeling of guilt. Contrary to public mythology, Navarre's career was not entirely spent at desk jobs in various rear headquarters. As a 19-year-old cadet, he had fought on the Western Front against Germany from May 1917 onward. Immediately after the war, he went to Syria, where he spent 2 years in anti-guerrilla fighting against Arab rebels. After a stay with the French occupation forces in Germany and studies at the French War College, Navarre spent 4 years, from 1930 to 1934, in the pacification campaigns in Morocco. He began to serve with French Army Intelligence in 1937, and during the fateful years of 1938-40, was the head of its German section. During the German occupation of France, Navarre served in the intelligence branch of the French underground. But in November 1944, after France was liberated, he led an armored regiment, the 5th Spahi, into Germany. After a regional command in Algeria and a staff position in Germany, Navarre became commander of the 5th French Armored Division in Germany. He was later appointed Chief of Staff to the commander of NATO's Central European Land Forces. When he was hand-picked for his new post by French Prime Minister René Maillard at the recommendation of Field Marshal Juin, France's then highest-ranking officer, Navarre was, by all standards of military judgment, an officer who was exceptionally well-qualified for the position. While without field experience in Indochina, he was nonetheless experienced in counter-guerrilla operations. The absence of prejudice toward operations in Indochina was considered, in fact, an asset. Moreover, his recent position in a high-ranking NATO command enabled him to see the Indochina war in the overall scheme of things. His experience must also have given him respect for the value of reliable intelligence. While Solon's departure from Indochina also brought about departures at other levels, it cannot be assumed that Navarre had to work with an entirely inexperienced assemblage of subordinate commanders. In any case, had he desired it, he could have demanded that Solon's subordinates stay on, at least temporarily. On the contrary, Navarre seemed quite happy to be able to put men of his own choice into key posts. For example, he in no way opposed the departure from Indochina of the commander of the key northern region, Major General François González de Linares, and his replacement by a considerably younger French brigadier general, who, until then, had commanded the 2nd Division de Marche de Tonkin, 2nd DMT, and who, to all appearances, was a study in physical and psychological contrasts to Navarre. Cogny, then 48 and a muscular 6 feet 4 inches tall, was probably the only French general who was both a graduate of France's most prestigious engineering school, École Polytechnique, and holder of a diploma in political science and a doctorate in jurisprudence, the latter two acquired on a bootleg basis when the army had sent him on special duty to acquire additional military engineering training while he personally preferred political science and law. Well-liked by his troops and irresistible to women, he had been one of the favorite subordinates of the late Marshal de Lattre de Tassigny, and had inherited from him a taste for military pomp and circumstance. An officially approved biographical article stated that, if a sudden furor takes hold of him, he lets it explode, masters it very rapidly, and does not bear any grudges. A favorable, if unofficial, observer, Jules Rat, says of Coigny that he was detested by his superiors for arguing orders, and confirms his thin skin. A single word can wound Coigny deeply. In that case, he does not forgive. He will charge head down on the person whom he thinks responsible for the wound, and will try to trample him. From Coigny's remarks about Navarre 10 years later, in what he calls a free confession, the latter character trait seems fairly well documented. Yet this was the man whom Navarre personally picked on May 21, 1953, to direct what surely was to become the decisive phase of the 8-year-long Indochina War. On that day also, Navarre made Coigny a major general. Navarre made several changes and innovations within his own general staff. He strove for a greater integration of the naval and air commands and the ground forces, ordering his new chief of staff, Major General Gambiez, radically to streamline his command structure, perhaps in an attempt to imitate the dash and drive with which the late Marshal de Lattre had inspired the Indochina command. Navarre, sometimes at great personal risk, visited literally every sector of Indochina in the space of a few weeks. He was particularly interested in the Lai Chau and Na San airheads. His airplane was hit in several places by communist anti-aircraft fire while visiting the latter base. Navarre even visited a mountain tribal guerrilla base deep inside communist territory, something no other commander-in-chief in Indochina had done. It was during his visit to Na San that Navarre met the commander of that base and of Mobile Group 7, Colonel Louis Berthet. Berthet was an officer who, even prior to Dien Bien Phu, had few friends among his peers. A graduate of the General Staff College, he had literary aspirations, and his preciousness of expression had provided the senior officers' messes in Indochina with a vast array of quotable quotes, some erroneously attributed to Berthet, others directly traceable to him. One of the more memorable was his characterization of the airhead of Na San as offering an indirect and bivalent protection of both Laos and the Red River Delta. Berthet caught the attention of General Navarre at Na San, and soon found himself on Navarre's staff as deputy chief for operations. Coigny, Berthet's immediate superior at Na San, was to say of him 10 years later that he was pregnant with a vast theory on the uses of fortified airheads. Coigny also asserts that it was Colonel Berthet who eventually convinced Navarre not only of the usefulness of Dien Bien Phu, but also of the overall correctness of the air-land base as a panacea for the dilemmas of the Indochina War. What made the air-land base concept so attractive was that it seemed to provide a solution to one of the key problems which faced the French commanders, one which still faces the South Vietnamese and their American allies more than 10 years later. How to spread a sufficient degree of insecurity into the enemy's own rear areas so as to compel him in turn to disperse his troops for the purpose of protecting those areas. Since successful infiltration of communist-held areas could be attempted only with hand-picked French and Vietnamese special forces units, conventional military means had to be found for something more massive than infiltration. This turned out to be strongly defended hedgehog positions resupplied by transport aircraft and supported, in case of direct enemy attack, by combat aircraft. In the spring of 1953, Navarre was content to take stock of the situation and to present to Paris a coherent scheme for French operations during the following year. At a conference held with regional commanders in Saigon on June 16, 1953, Navarre presented an outline of the battle plan he intended to submit 1 month later to the National Defense Committee, the French equivalent of the American National Security Council. It is not clear whether the occupation of Dien Bien Phu was discussed at that meeting, or whether Navarre had decided to shelve General Solon's Directive No. 40. It is now established, however, that Navarre had by then been convinced of the military and political uselessness of the airhead of Nassan. Militarily, Nassan tied down the effectiveness of a light division and an important share of the available air transport tonnage without tying down even its own equivalent in enemy manpower. Politically, it was nothing but an abstract point on the map, neither a tribal provincial capital nor a geographically important communications hub, as Lai Chau and Dien Bien Phu were. General Cogny, therefore, did not object to the evacuation of Nassan, since it would provide him with first-class troops sorely needed elsewhere. At the same time, and this is likely to have taken place at the commanders' conference of June 16th, it was he who suggested the reoccupation of Dien Bien Phu. Cogny was to express his reasoning in the following words 10 years later. I suggested the occupation of Dien Bien Phu to install there a simple mooring point, mole d'amarrage, for our military and political activities in northwestern Tonkin. We thus would derive an advantage from the hostility of the Thai mountaineers against the Viet Minh from the plains, who seek to subject them to their yoke. Unfortunately, the capital of Lai Chau cannot even be defended against a modest attack. I felt a certain degree of urgency in preparing the eventual transfer of the Thai capital to Dien Bien Phu, so as to be able to face a probable increase of the local danger, but also and above all, in order to present an additional argument in favor of the evacuation of Nassan, which I insistently requested from General Navarre. Much now hinged on how Navarre and Cogny would define their respective concepts of whether Dien Bien Phu was an air-land base or a mooring point. Navarre would argue to the last that, indeed, it was Cogny who had proposed the occupation of Dien Bien Phu, and Cogny would argue with equal insistence that the rationale for occupying Dien Bien Phu hinged entirely on his own concept of Dien Bien Phu as a resupply point for tribal guerrilla units who were to operate in the Viet Minh's rear areas. The presence at Dien Bien Phu of Deo Van Long's Thai federal administration would provide political competition for Ho Chi Minh's own administration. It may be pointed out that the two explanations are not mutually exclusive. Cogny himself admits that he did propose to Navarre what amounted to an implementation of General Solon's Directive No. 40, of whose existence he surely was aware. There is no evidence in any available documentation, including the French military archives and the heated public controversy between Generals Navarre and Cogny, which resulted in a lawsuit in 1955 and a series of highly emotional articles and open letters in 1963, affirming that General Cogny had clearly expressed to Navarre his own interpretation of what he meant Dien Bien Phu to be. Nor is there any evidence to show that General Navarre had made clear to General Cogny at that time that he meant Dien Bien Phu to become a jungle fortress designed to withstand a regular siege. On July 17th, Navarre presented his plans to the French Joint Chiefs, presided over by Marshal Juin, who approved them with the reservation that all the additional forces and equipment that Navarre required might not become available. On July 24th, Navarre addressed the whole National Defense Committee, composed of the Joint Chiefs, the Prime Minister, the Ministers of Foreign Affairs, Finance, Interior, Defense, Overseas Affairs, and Indochina Affairs, the service secretaries, and presided over by the President of the Republic. That meeting was crucial in deciding the fate of northern Indochina in general, and that of Dien Bien Phu in particular. Navarre insisted later that, after long and confusing discussions, no firm decision was taken on any of the questions raised. In his own memoirs on the subject, Joseph Laniel, who was then Prime Minister in one of the Fourth Republic's musical chairs governments, and who had become Premier on July 3, 1953, commented on Navarre's assertion by saying that the stenographic transcript of the meeting clearly showed that he had received instructions to abandon Laos if necessary, and that he had objected to those instructions on the grounds that they would have created an unfavorable psychological effect in Indochina. Navarre, in turn, asserted that, 1. He did not know that a transcript had been kept of the meeting until he read about it in Laniel's book, 2. The transcript, if it existed, may well have been tampered with, and 3. In any case, the transcript was ambiguous. General Georges Catrou, who headed the French government's 1955 commission investigating the Dien Bien Phu disaster, the report to this day is a state secret, and whose own writings are far from tender toward General Navarre, tends to side with the commander-in-chief on this point, since Dien Bien Phu made sense only if the French government desired to hold Laos, or at least large parts of it. Navarre's argument hinges primarily on whether or not he had been fully informed as to the French government's intentions about Laos. As Catrou described this situation on the basis of all the testimony his commission had heard or received, it appears that the French Joint Chiefs, after having heard Navarre, had recommended to the National Defense Committee that no obligation be put upon him to defend Laos. This recommendation was apparently communicated only by indirection to Navarre at the July 24th meeting, and was not then embodied in the form of a governmental directive. Catrou's investigation commission found, in fact, that it had taken the French government until November 13, 1963, to express its view on Laos in a formal directive addressed to Navarre's theoretical civilian superior, the Secretary of State for Associated States, that is, Indochina, Affairs, Monsieur Marc Jacquet. According to Catrou, Navarre received this communication only on December 4th, 2 weeks after the first wave of Bijar's paratroopers had landed on DZ Natasha. No explanation for this incredible delay in transmitting a vital directive was ever offered. Dien Bien Phu itself had been mentioned at the July 24th meeting of the National Defense Committee, but only in passing, since in Navarre's mind an operation at Dien Bien Phu was to have a purely secondary character, and was in any case entirely within his sphere of responsibility as military commander in Indochina. Moreover, he had already made up his mind about it. On the following day, July 25th, his staff in Saigon issued Directive No. 563, which represented the first formalized document providing for the occupation of Dien Bien Phu. It presented the operation as a preventive action against the communist thrust through the upper Mekong River, that is, northern Laos. The political stage was now set for the military drama that was to follow. Henceforth, the planning of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu took on the preordained air of a Greek tragedy. On August 12, 1953, the airhead of Nassan was successfully evacuated by the French. The communists were so totally surprised by that evacuation that even the last of the rear guard of the 9,000-man garrison were picked up by air without enemy interference. This rear guard comprised a company of Thai partisans commanded by a French lieutenant with the unlikely name of Makowiak, who, with his straw-blonde hair, bluish eyes, and square build, fully looked the part of a Polish peasant from the plains of Poznan. Mako, as he was known to his intimates, had been given the delicate job because of his perfect familiarity with both the terrain of the Thai country and the tribal languages there. Those two capabilities were to stand him in good stead later, during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. The rapid evacuation of Nassan permitted the safe withdrawal of all men and weapons, but compelled the French to leave behind many of the fixed installations, large stocks of reserve ammunition, and the precious pierced steel mats with which part of the airfield was covered. The vast minefields, which covered the various strong points, were also left behind, and later carefully dug up by the Viet Minh and used against the French elsewhere. The French sabotaged as much of the materiel as possible, and the French Air Force bombed many of the remaining installations, but a great deal nevertheless fell into communist hands. Inasmuch as General Cogny regained control of 9 battalions and of a great deal of airlift capability, the evacuation of Nassan was considered a clear success. Unfortunately, it also heightened the confidence within Navarre's general staff in the ability of the French forces to occupy such an airhead and to evacuate it successfully when it was no longer useful. On October 22, 1953, France signed with the then and often later Prime Minister of Laos, Prince Souphanouphouma, a treaty of association and several conventions which simultaneously reaffirmed the independence of Laos and its membership in the French Union. Particular importance was attached to this treaty because Laos was first of the 3 Indochinese states, the others being Vietnam and Cambodia, to complete signing such a treaty with France. While the treaty did not contain a hard and fast clause making it mandatory for France to come to the defense of Laos, the commitment was clearly implied. Indeed, there was no other reason for Laos to sign the treaty. This further reinforced Navarre's conviction that in the case of a second Viet Minh invasion of Laos, the first, it will be recalled, took place in the winter and spring of 1953, an all-out attempt would have to be made to defend that country. Indeed, as was shown, Navarre argued in 1955, as well as in 1963, that he had not received an explicit directive from the French government at home as to whether to abandon Laos or not, a decision, Navarre avers, that was entirely political and thus had to be made by Paris and not by him. "Suppose," said Navarre in 1963, "that I had abandoned Laos on my own initiative and opened to the Viet Minh the road toward total victory. I would be branded today as the man who had betrayed the honor of his country." As was shown earlier, Navarre's doubts were resolved by the French governmental directive of November 13th, which he received after the beginning of the attack on Dien Bien Phu. In the meantime, however, the signing of the French-Laotian Treaty may have reinforced Navarre's impression that Laos had to be defended and that the valley of Dien Bien Phu was the place from which to defend it. On November 2, 1953, Navarre's operations chief issued Directive No. 852, outlining the command channels for the forthcoming operation. General Cogny, as the commander of ground forces in North Vietnam, became the overall commander of the operation, which was to be carried out between November 15th and 20th, or not later than December 1st. The initial number of troops to be used was to be limited to 6 battalions, later to be reduced to 5. If one is to judge from the memoranda submitted to Cogny by his subordinates on November 4th, the effect of that directive on Cogny's staff in Hanoi was that of a bombshell. Couched in the first person singular, since they were to be addressed by Cogny to Navarre, they were unanimously and even vociferously opposed to the whole operation. "It seems that to the general staff, EMIFT, the occupation of Dien Bien Phu will close the road to Luang Prabang and deprive the Viet Minh of the rice of the region. In that kind of country, you can't interdict a road. This is a European-type notion, without any value here. The Viets can get through anywhere. We can see this right here in the Red River Delta. The rice surplus provided by Dien Bien Phu will only feed one division for 3 months. Therefore, it would only make a fractional contribution to an enemy campaign in Laos. I am persuaded that Dien Bien Phu shall become, whether we like it or not, a battalion meat grinder, with no possibility of large scale radiating out from it as soon as it will be blocked by a single Viet Minh regiment. See example of Nasan. While a clear-cut threat exists against the Red River Delta, which becomes more evident every day, we will immobilize 300 kilometers from Hanoi, the equivalent of 3 regimental combat teams. They represent all the reinforcements which we have received, which permit us to inflict losses upon the enemy. The consequences of such a decision can be extremely grave, and EMIFT must know this." A second memorandum went into details of the cost of an operation at Dien Bien Phu. It emphasized that being cut off from the rice of Dien Bien Phu would be only of minor importance to the enemy in any case, that French-led guerrilla units in the area were not yet effective, and that an early operation at Dien Bien Phu could well bring about their destruction. The memorandum also pointed out that effective interdiction through aerial bombardment of the main access roads to Dien Bien Phu would absorb 3/4 of all the combat aircraft available in Northern Command. It further underlined that the 5 battalions initially planned for Dien Bien Phu would soon have to face at least 9 communist battalions readily available in the area, and that these, in turn, would have to be matched by more French units withdrawn from the Red River Delta. The memorandum ended with a request on the part of Cogny for more troops and air transport, if, against the clearly unfavorable opinion which the commanding general of the ground forces in North Vietnam admits himself to respectfully express, the decision to carry out the operation was maintained by the GHQ in Saigon. The last note merely emphasized the difficulty of withdrawing the garrison of Lai Chau toward Dien Bien Phu and prophesied that the Viet Minh forces would be able to establish a strongly defended roadblock position between the two airheads. This wholly negative appraisal of what was to become Operation Castor was followed 2 days later by a personal letter from Cogny to Navarre, which was a great deal less clear-cut. Navarre gave the necessary orders to his staff to prepare the launching of the operation for November 20th. Observers who otherwise were almost totally sympathetic to the viewpoint of Cogny nevertheless felt that in this instance his position had been ambiguous. Prime Minister Joseph Laniel was to explain that attitude by what he called the umbrella politics of certain French senior commanders, who, according to Laniel, were concerned with covering themselves more against personal responsibility than against enemy attacks. That concern leads them to an excessive usage of memoranda, reports, and to the refusal to undertake any initiative without a written order. It also leads them to request means that go far beyond what can be provided, so as to have, in case of failure, the excuse of not having been listened to. In a recent rebuttal to such views, and to the suggestion that his deep disagreement with Navarre should at that point have led to Cogny's resignation, or at least the offer of resignation, from the command of a zone which was about to engage in an operation with which he personally was in apparently complete disagreement, Cogny argued that, once he had presented his objections to the operation, discipline demanded that he execute the given orders. While he could have tiptoed away from the forthcoming disaster with his major general stars safely on his shoulders, he felt that he had an obligation toward his own troops in Tonkin to remain at his post. He was to use the same argument also to explain why he did not resign later on, when Navarre almost unilaterally decided to transform the valley of Dien Bien Phu from a guerrilla force mooring point into a set-piece jungle fortress. It is probable that this total breakdown of rapport between Navarre in Saigon and his key commander in Hanoi, and to all appearances between their immediate subordinates, had a decisive, if not fatal, effect on the manner in which plans were eventually implemented. As was shown earlier, Cogny in turn informed his subordinate Air Force and paratroop commanders on November 11th and 12th of their part in the forthcoming operation, and in his orders to paratrooper General Gilles, he once again emphasized his understanding of the Dien Bien Phu airhead as a mooring point for guerrilla operations by instructing Gilles that the defense of the Dien Bien Phu airfield would exclude any system designed to provide a belt of strong points for the airfield. The commander at Lai Chau, Lieutenant Colonel Trong Khar, was informed on November 13th that his command would have to be sacrificed, but he was ordered at the same time to repress any rumors about the fact that this was going to take place. On the following day, November 14th, General Navarre issued final operational instructions, known in French military parlance as IPS, or Personal and Secret Instructions, to the regional commanders who would have to cooperate with one another in the matter of the Dien Bien Phu operation. General Cogny in North Vietnam, and Colonel Boucher de Crèvecoeur, the commander of all French forces in Laos. For, as Cogny was to emphasize 10 years later, Dien Bien Phu was located a mere 8 miles from the Laotian border, and much that was going on in its hinterland obviously concerned the commander in Laos as much as the commander in North Vietnam. Yet, since all the logistical support bases for the Battle of Dien Bien Phu were located in the Red River Delta, and the troops stationed in Dien Bien Phu were to come from General Cogny's command, most of the decisions were finally made in Hanoi. It is unclear to what extent the lack of a single overall command at Dien Bien Phu hampered the eventual direction of the battle, but there is doubtless a certain measure of justification in Cogny's assertion that Dien Bien Phu had become the key to the battle for all of northern Indochina, and thus should have been under a single overall commander. In the IPS of November 14th, Navarre again outlined the political and strategic importance of maintaining inside the Thai tribal territory a French position which would cover Laos as well. The operation, set for November 20th, provided for the creation of an airhead at Dien Bien Phu that would establish a land link with French forces in northern Laos and would provide support for Lai Chau until its eventual evacuation. The three directives of November 14th contained a special appendix dealing with political and administrative problems, since the evacuation of Lai Chau implied the transfer of the whole Thai Tribal Federation's administration to Dien Bien Phu. With only 5 days to go, Cogny's staff shifted into high gear. There were difficulties to be surmounted, inasmuch as the bulk of the troops and aircraft to be involved in the operation were still heavily engaged in the southern part of the Red River Delta. Still, those of Cogny's aides who were doubtful about the whole operation were given another, final opportunity to express their misgivings to the commander-in-chief. On November 15th, Marc Jacquet, the Secretary of State for Associated States Affairs, arrived in Saigon, apparently unaware that his office in Paris had received on the previous day the important directive of the National Defense Council inviting Navarre to modify his strategy. 2 days later, on November 17th, Navarre, Jacquet, and French Civilian High Commissioner in Indochina, Maurice de Jonge, and Vietnamese Prime Minister Nguyen Van Tham flew to Hanoi and were briefed on the general outlines of the forthcoming operation. None of them objected in any way to it, and Marc Jacquet, by all accounts, felt no particular need to inform Paris by telegram of this military move. While this routine briefing was held for the civilians, the more dramatic military discussion took place among Navarre, Cogny, and their respective staffs. Last-minute intelligence information had shown that Dien Bien Phu was far from undefended and was in fact held by parts of Communist Regiment 148. Also, an important shift had taken place in the movements of People's Army Division 316. The 316th Division was not the best of all communist outfits, but it was excellently suited for operations in the highlands because two of its three infantry regiments, the 176th and the 174th, were recruited from among tribesmen who spoke the same language as the inhabitants of the Thai highlands. In addition to its three infantry regiments, Division 316 also had an artillery battalion, the 980th, equipped with recoilless rifles and heavy mortars. On the basis of this intelligence, it should have been obvious to the French that Dien Bien Phu was an unlikely choice as a mooring point for light, mobile guerrilla forces. In the face of a full-scale assault by a regular communist division, which could be reinforced by additional heavy elements, the French at Dien Bien Phu had two choices, either to evacuate the valley altogether, or to make it impregnable by transporting into it an adequate garrison supported by vast amounts of firepower. As it turned out, the French High Command never had enough troops at its disposal even to occupy the approximately 75 square miles of valley bottom, let alone defend and hold the line of surrounding hills. The valley, with its minimal perimeter of about 50 miles, would easily have required the presence of as many 700-man battalions as there were miles. And since only six such battalions were available for the operation, it was a foregone conclusion that any compromise between the two alternatives was bound to be unsatisfactory, if not altogether disastrous. The orders issued by General Cogny's headquarters on November 30, 1953, had already begun to show the effects of that compromise. At Dien Bien Phu, where the Airborne Division Command Element, EDAP, of General Gilles had been replaced by the headquarters of the Paratroop Operational Group, GOP, of Colonel Bastiani, the news meant that the lightly armed paratroop forces would have to be replaced by normal field units of excellent quality, and that the light field entrenchments around Dien Bien Phu would have to be replaced by permanent field fortifications. In effect, the new directive gave the GOP of Dien Bien Phu the mission to 1. Guarantee at the very least the free usage of the airfield, 2. Gather intelligence from as far away as possible, and 3. Proceed with the withdrawal to Dien Bien Phu of the units from Lai Chau. The directive gave specific and detailed instructions as to how each of these missions was to be fulfilled. The free use of the Dien Bien Phu airfield was explained to mean that the whole defensive position of Dien Bien Phu was to be held without any thought of withdrawal, sans esprit de recul. In effect, the troops at Dien Bien Phu were to maintain freedom of movement within a radius of 8 kilometers around the airfield. Correctly enough, General Cogny's headquarters foresaw that the major enemy effort would come from the east or northeast, and it ordered the commander at Dien Bien Phu to concentrate his defensive efforts in that direction. As to the directive's second point, offensive stabs from Dien Bien Phu to the north and northeast, in direction of Ban Na Tao and Tuan Xiao, the garrison was also to use at least one half of its strength in operations designed to inflict heavy losses on the enemy and to delay his laying a tight siege ring around the valley. At the same time, Dien Bien Phu was directed to operate a link-up through the roadless jungle with Colonel de Crèvecoeur's French Laotian forces advancing toward Dien Bien Phu from Muang Khoa. Lastly, the evacuation of Lai Chau was to take place at the order of General Cogny and was to be covered by French-led guerrilla formations, who were also to continue their activities in the Lai Chau area after the withdrawal of all French regular units. There were two major aspects of the November 30th directive that can only be characterized as unrealistic. The first was the supposition that a garrison of 5,000 men, in terrain that was largely jungle-covered and impassable, could defend a roughly circular area with a perimeter measuring about 31 miles, that is, a radius of 8 kilometers around the airstrip. As past experience in Indochina had shown, an average 700-man battalion could hold a line of no more than 1,500 yards, or even less. The second was the clear implication that sophisticated field defenses were to be constructed, even though the directive specifically prescribed that, at the very least, one half of the garrison was constantly to be away on patrol. As will be seen later, the garrison's command obeyed this provision of the November 30th directive to the letter, with the result that only scant attention was paid to a thorough in-depth defense of the terrain until long after the siege ring had tightened. And this had to be done with a garrison constantly